You're listening to the Podcast Network. Listen, learn, evolve.
Atomic Insights.
Good evening, this is Rod Adams coming to you from Annapolis, Maryland. It's time for Atomic Show number 19.
Evening, this is Shane Brown coming to you from Los Lumas, New Mexico, and we wanted to talk tonight about the Canadian situation with regards to the kinds of things that are going on in Canada with the new possibility of new nuclear power production coming online and refurbishments and all kinds of commentary going on online.
And I just wanted to mention that we, in fact, are delivering on the request from one of our listeners, Mr. Randall Levitt, who has suggested after last week's show talking about Europe that maybe it was time to take a look at North America and see what's going on up in Canada, because a lot of activities are happening up there. So yep. We just want to let you know that if you have a suggestion, we will listen.
So where do you start?
Well, I guess the first place to start is the announcement of Ontario's expansion plan or energy plan or what their way forward is. I think they announced that within the last week or so.
No.
Is that not one of the places that you studied tonight?
Well, I was looking at more of a technical side rather than the policy side and just making sure I wasn't going to utter anything overly ignorant as opposed to my...
Okay, then I'll talk a little bit about the policy side. Ontario, Canada, has a supply problem. They, at one point, had a very active planning process and... like most utilities, were able to look ahead and project their load growth over years. Back in the late 1980s, early 1990s, that planning process was essentially ignored. And part of it occurred because the steady growth in energy demand was interrupted by a rather deep recession, which caused the growth in the economy to slow down, and there is generally a pretty one-to-one or close-to-one relationship between the growth in an economy and the growth in the demand for electricity. So in the period between 1990 or so and now, essentially all demand growth caused by increase in population and some improvements to the economy have been met by restoring some coal-fired power plants to service and by building natural gas-fired gas turbines. Kind of the similar choice has been made by many utilities in the United States. About 2 years ago, a new government came into being in Ontario, partly based on a promise to work to shut down the coal-fired power plants to reduce the contributions to greenhouse gas emissions and to reduce the other pollutants caused by emissions from coal-fired power plants. That goal is rather ambitious unless new supplies can be brought online. So the government undertook a study and within the last week or so has released their proposal. And the proposal includes a refurbishment of several of the existing CANDU reactors, which have been idle for some time. Some of them have been shut down as long as 10 years. And then Ontario also believes that they will probably need to build two new nuclear power plants during the next 15 years. Some estimates... Go ahead.
There was a story about the price tag on the refurbishment plus the two new power plant proposal that was talked about on a podcast that we both got, or in a news podcast that we got a chance to listen to today. coming from Living on Earth, and we'll go ahead. We'll probably post the link after the show. It was fairly even-handed, and the numbers were fairly impressive. It was $60 billion U.S. to refurbish. 40% would be for, let's see, I have the article up, and yeah, $40 billion to refurbish and build two new facilities, and then another $20 billion to invest in conservation, develop more hydro, stimulate solar, wind, biomass, etc. Call a quote-unquote balanced plan, well, my quote's not his, by the Minister of Energy, Dwight Duncan. There's more information in the article, and I won't go into the whole article. But
so that's Duncan McGuinty. Is he the leader? Is that the name?
That sounds familiar, but I don't think they're the same person. I think this is a new Minister of Energy, but any listeners can correct us if I'm wrong on the comments or by email.
So one of the big issues that is facing Ontario Hydro now is that once the decision is made to invest in two new nuclear power plants, the big decision is what new nuclear power plants do they intend to buy?
It's a question of going with the, if you wanted to look at it simplistically, you could either go with what you've got, the CANDU system, which has worked very well, and in spite of the overruns, I think the overruns that have happened with the CANDU system have happened for a lot of the same reasons that they happened to the plants in the United States, in fact, the amount of time it took to complete a plant kept going up and up and up, and the cost of the interest on those loans kept going up and up because of the increased time.
And
then the other two choices would be to invest in new technology, CANDU, for instance, the ACR 700, or to buy technology from a foreign supplier, like, for instance, pressurized light water reactors or boiling light water reactors, such as are manufactured in France or Japan, and the United States also has experience with.
And, of course, right now the major competitors would be seen to be Areva from France, Westinghouse, which is thought to be an American company but is really owned by Toshiba now, and General Electric, and probably the Canadians wouldn't consider the other major vendor that's often talked about in international competitions, which would be Russia's Rosatomstroy, I believe that's how they pronounce it. So what do you think? What would your recommendation be if you were the person who had to make a technical choice on the reactor for suitable for Canada?
Based on what I've read, I think the best, my extremely limited perspective speaking here, I think my choice would probably be to go with refurbishing the CANDU facilities that they have and start investing in the ACR 700, because the ACR 700 builds on many, many decades of very fine experience that Canadians have had with the CANDU system, patching up a few minor issues that they've had with the technology and making the technology a lot more modular, because the size of the reactors are smaller and they can more easily fit into smaller grids. And I had heard at one point, I believe this was on Jeremy Whitlock's Canadian Nuclear Fact, was at one point the Canadians were in talks with many countries about exporting CANDU technology, and one of them was actually Vietnam, which would have been a very neat thing to see.
Well, one of the things that comes into play from a business point of view is that the CANDU reactors have been pretty successful in international endeavors, particularly in India, has developed their own design based on the CANDU power plant. And then I think South Korea also has CANDU reactors, because aren't they the folks that have worked on the DUPIC system, which we've
yes.
talked about before?
Yep. The South Koreans have one reactor that I know is a candidate, I believe is Wolsong 1, and I think they might have two or three more. The actual breakdown by country, if I were to look.
Well, while you're Googling that, my point was going to be that most purchasers or international purchasers will have a difficult time in choosing a reactor design that is not being produced in the home country of the supplier. For a lot of reasons, there's reluctance by countries that don't know as much about nuclear power as some of the more experienced countries. They don't want to buy a design that where the company that's selling it can't even sell it at home. So this choice that Ontario is going to make will have a big impact on whether or not the CANDU reactors are able to get additional international markets.
Yeah.
And since the CANDU team, which includes Atomic Energy of Canada Limited, Babcock and Wilcox of Canada, GE of Canada, and a couple other companies, I believe that whole team includes about 20,000 employees in Canada. So this is a big decision.
Yeah. I have an answer for you on South Korea. There are four operating CANDU plants, and this is from Jeremy Whitlock's page. And there is also a surprising number of plants operating outside of Canada and India. There are two operating in China. As a matter of fact, the two that started in China had, I believe, the world record fastest ground break to first criticality of any nuclear power plant that's ever been constructed.
Okay, what was it?
That was, I believe it was 4 years from standing start.
Okay, well, that must be commercial nuclear power plant.
Yeah, commercial nuclear in terms of large. Yeah, I realize that the Nautilus and many of the naval nuclear power plants, I mean, it's basically a matter of getting the fuel together, putting it up, and doing the engineering and cutting the steel, and it went much faster.
I think the world record is the one that I have the video of on my Atomic Insights website. Which
yeah.
Is the
okay, so if we go with Camp Century, that kind of blows that out of the water. But given a choice between no nuclear power versus, hey, we're excited about getting a plant up in 4 years where it used to take 15 because of issues. I'll take the four.
Yeah,
but
four.
I agree that there's lots of room for improvement. And some of the technology that they use to make those plants start up as fast as they do is Qinshan is the name of the one in China. And first construction started in June 1998. And first operation December 31st, 2002, so just a little bit over 4 years. So I believe that's definitely the fastest construction for a CANDU facility, or a modern CANDU facility, at least.
Yeah, and there's some technical advantages to the CANDU that have given it the ability to over the life, when you, particularly if you factor out some of the plants that have been shut down for lack of a market. They've had pretty good lifetime capacity factors in the CANDU reactors.
I think part of the reason why they can get that is the relative ease of fueling, the fact that they have online refueling and they can shuffle the fuel back and forth in the core in order to balance out the power and eliminate hot spots and basically minimize the stress on the fuel. So, the refueling machines that they use are just neat to watch. I mean, they're these two. Basically, a CANDU reactor is a cylinder on order of about 5 or 6 meters in diameter. It could be large. That has a very large number of pressure tubes running down the length of the cylinder. That barrel that is called a calandria is filled with heavy water, which is deuterium oxide, which is basically it's a heavy isotope of hydrogen.
So it's a hydrogen that has a neutron in it.
Yep, that's a hydrogen that has one extra neutron as opposed to two, which would be tritium. So there's Calandria sitting on its side, and all these tubes have fuel bundles in them that are about a meter long and something like 20 centimeters or 10 centimeters in diameter. And they feed in these fuel bundles, which they're much shorter, so you don't have the very long fuel bundles that you have in American plants. And they shuffle them back in, back and forth, and they have an entire fuel handling system that constantly handles spent fuel on the order of something like one bundle a day moves.
Yeah, that's a pretty impressive system. The other advantage that the CANDU has, in my mind, particularly as we're going forward, or as Canada's going forward, is that if they move towards the pressurized water type technology, they're going to be kind of standing in line waiting for the construction of some of the limiting components, particularly the pressure vessels that are associated with the pressurized water reactor. By having
it is very hard to take a sheet of steel 8 inches thick and the size of the side of an apartment building and bend it into a cylinder.
It's a job that can't really be rushed. It takes a large machine, it takes a lot of heat, and it takes a very patient process to make that turn into a very nice, non-stressed cylinder that's going to be able to withstand the rigors of serving as a pressurized water reactor pressure vessel for 60-year lifetime.
And the lack of a industrial capability to build pressure vessels of that size and scope was, I believe, one of the contributing reasons why the Canadians went with the CANDU design. Is that rather than having one large monolithic pressure vessel, you have several hundred smaller ones, which are the pressure tubes that run through the Calandria.
Yep, and then, of course, there's another huge reason why Canada went with a heavy water moderated reactor, particularly in the very early years of developing nuclear power. And that is because the heavy water moderated reactor allows them to use natural uranium as the feed source.
Yep. Plus, the neutron economy of that design of reactor allows them a very wide latitude in how many different kinds of fuel that can handle. Could burn thorium. It can burn spent nuclear fuel from United States type or pressurized water, light water reactors. It can be operated in almost a seed and blanket configuration. I believe that may be some of the driving technology. I'm not really all that spun up on it right now, but basically it's an extremely diverse fuel capable reactor cycle, and that's just the nature of the beast.
One of the reasons, and for people that can't quite understand that, what we pull out of commercial light water reactors in the United States has roughly about 0.9% uranium-235 still remaining in it.
And, which, conveniently enough, is the exact enrichment that is the design enrichment. It's close enough to the design enrichment for the ACR 700, isn't it? Slightly enriched fuel.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it's very, very close, which is the basis for that Dupic fuel cycle that we've mentioned in previous podcasts, where South Korea, for example, is planning to use the leftovers from their light water reactors as the feed source for their heavy water reactors. Very nice way to get more overall energy out of the same initial fuel load and to reduce the amount of waste that's produced by producing a certain amount of energy.
Right. And the Dupic cycle also has the benefit of probably being, as far as I know, it's the lowest capital intensive type of reprocessing system that there is. And in fact, it's basically you're chopping up long, thin bundles of fuel rods, taking off the cladding and exposing the uranium dioxide fuel pellets, which are still better than 95% uranium dioxide, and chopping them, basically breaking them down into a powder inside of a sealed facility where the fission product gases, which cause a very slight swelling on the fuel pellets, can off-gas and be captured for storage, long-term interim storage, long-term storage. And then the powder can be remanufactured into fuel bundles that are capable of running in a CANDU.
So they do do a physical process, but there's no chemistry involved.
There's no chemistry. It's called a dry reprocessing technology.
Wow. Of course, I sometimes wonder why it wouldn't be possible to simply take the cladding off. You've got those nice pellets that really haven't even changed much and stick them back into other cladding.
But I believe that was the dry reprocessing is the second generation technology. I think the first generation of the DuPont technology is literally stripping the cladding off and then remanufacturing the pellets as is into fuel bundles and then doing your criticality calculations with the gaseous fuel vision products present.
I guess my system was just too simple. Maybe there's got to be some disadvantages that I'm not aware of from a reactor physics.
If we make it too simple, there's no jobs for engineers.
Oh, I forgot about that part. The nuclear industry is very good at making sure there's plenty of employment, which, quite honestly, I can't fault. I like the fact that the nuclear industry tends to be a very large number of employees per unit power, but that's okay because the overall cost per unit power is still lower than it would be if you were burning natural gas or oil, and nuclear power today in the U.S. anyway is about 5 or 10% less than the average cost of coal, so it's very competitive and provides good, well-paying jobs, which is kind of cool. One of the reasons that Canada's had some issues over the years with the fact they haven't really built very much is they had a very strong opposition groups that came into being and were able to delay the construction processes. And because of certain laws in Canada, the opposition groups got paid to intervene.
These are the infamous intervener groups that Jeremy talks about in his editorials.
Yes.
The editorials on the Canadian nuclear FAQ site is probably some of the most entertaining reading I've ever written, I've ever had the honor to read.
And by the way,
Jeremy's an excellent writer.
Yeah, and by the way, he is a nuke, so that's pretty good. He's got both sides of the brain working. But Jeremy Whitlock's Canadian nuclear FAQs has been on the web since about 1994, I believe, 1995.
Just past his 10th anniversary. And yeah. Changed his domain. He had a domain that was a little bit harder to remember. And then he got the domain Canadian or nuclearfaq.ca a couple of years ago.
Yep. Well, that's not unusual. The Atomic Insights website had a different domain at one time when I was hitchhiking on the good graces of the University of Wisconsin ANS chapter.
Yep. And, as a matter of fact, there, if you do a search for some of the back issues of Atomic Energy Insights, they still have a lot of the back issues from the first run back in the mid-90s.
Well, actually, right now they all get redirected to the atomicinsights.com.
I might not have clicked on those links recently. It might have been a few years since they've and since then they've probably set up the redirect.
The
plus, you can always dig them up from archive.org.
Right, the links still work, and fortunately for me, there was a period of time on Atomic Insights where I had the equivalent going of too poor to paint, too proud to whitewash. and I didn't have much time or energy to maintain the site, so I didn't do much to it. And lo and behold, during that period of time, Google came into being, and Google makes it so much easier to find things if you leave them in the same place. And if you have links that have been established and remain valid for a long period of time, makes it far easier for a crawler to dig through websites and find the good stuff if you don't move it around or if you don't have databases serving up the web pages.
Right.
So sometimes, like the people that have gone into the restoration business, they like finding houses where nobody and it really disturbed much because they were too poor to do anything to it. Back to Kent, Ontario, I'm encouraged by the program that they have in place. I think that they've made some good decisions. Certainly refurbishing existing reactor plants is a smart thing to do. They've already made a large investment in the plants there. Not all of the, I think they're refurbishing, is it Pickering now?
I believe they're refurbishing Pickering. I think the British company that's taken over Bruce Power is thinking about refurbishing the other two reactors at Bruce Power on Lake Huron. Darlington is too new for refurbishment, I think. There's one other, there's Point Lepreau, which is in New Brunswick, and they just had a royal row about 3 or 4 months ago when the decision was up for vote in the New Brunswick legislature about whether to refurbish or whether to shut the plant down. And I believe that the decision came out just barely in favor, just over enough of a majority to refurbish. And that was nice to see, since Point Lepreau is responsible by itself for over a third of New Brunswick's power supply.
And I guess the big problem with Point Lepreau is it's only, what, a two-unit facility?
I think it's just a one-unit, actually.
And that's sometimes difficult to make those kind of investments pay off. You know, when you've got something like Pickering, which is a eight-unit facility.
Yeah,
I think they're only refurbishing four of them. I'm going to do a quick search and get that right, so I don't.
Pickering A, 1 through 4. Pickering B, 5 through 8. So cool.
Yeah. Isn't
okay?
Google,
so they
Google
have. Google. There are 6 operational units at Pickering. 2 of them are laid up, and I believe those 2 are the ones that are going into refurbishment. And that's on Ontario Hydro's site.
Okay, and I know that there's going to be some of the existing facilities. There's just too many things that have to be fixed to make it worthwhile.
Yeah. So one of the big things that people talk about in the Canadian journalism community is the need for the CANDUs to have the big part of the refurbishment, as I understand it, is replacement of the pressure tubes, since there are so many of them, and they're much thinner for their size than a full size pressurized water monolithic pressure vessel. So in the process of refurbishing, it has to take all the fuel out and has to clean it up, and it's a fairly involved process. I believe they finished a refurbishment not too long ago on another facility. Pickering 4 was back in service on September 25th, 2003, and I believe it was sometime in the late 90s it went offline, maybe, and they had it back up in a fairly short time frame. They had the other plants, the other units at the facility were able to pick up the slack. But that's the replacement of the pressure tubes, I believe, it's planned for in the design of the facility. I think that's part of what catches people off guard, is they think this is something that this is something they obviously didn't know about, versus not only did they know about it, they designed for it and they cost for it.
It's interesting, when you make design choices about things, you can, you know, try to make things that last forever. But if you find out you can't make them last forever, then it doesn't make sense to make them last, say, two-thirds of the time.
Right.
Because why would you want to, you know, make a big investment, you know, with only one-third of the life left?
There's a great story in a book. He's a civil engineer at Duke University. He's written a bunch of books. His name is Henry Petrosky, and he's got a book out. Has had a book out for 20 years called To Engineer as Human. It's one of my personal favorites. And he's got a quote in there from some collection of English literature from the 19th century. It's a story called The One Hoss Shay. Basically about a Scottish deacon who was tired in the 18th century, like 1750-something, just got tired of the original story is much more lyrical than my paraphrasing. But basically, the Scottish deacon got tired of his carriage constantly breaking down, so he went and basically turned the safety factor up on every component of the carriage. So it's this one hoss shay, and it lasted 100 years to the day. And then his far descendants driving along one day in the one hoss shay, and then all of the components fail all at once at the exact 100th anniversary.
Yep.
Weak links are good, especially weak links that you've planned for and designed for and that you can replace fairly easily.
Well, certainly that's part of the design choice. If you realize that a certain component is going to need maintenance, you make some design choices to allow that maintenance to occur in the most expeditious fashion possible and to at the least cost. Of course, you know, we listened to that podcast from what the heck was the name of it?
Living on Earth.
Living on Earth. And quite honestly, although it seemed not too bad, there were a lot of slanted phrases that I heard listening to it.
Building an outhouse without digging a hole is one of them.
Right. And, you know, there's an idea that, well, there was leaks and radioactivity. Well, of course, it's nuclear power. There's going to be associated radioactivity. Leaks in piping systems are a fact. Engineers can do the best they can, and things are going to have a certain amount of leakage. The question is, does that leakage harm anyone? And when you compare the emissions or the leakage from nuclear power plants to the regular day-to-day emissions from other sources, the comparison's hard to overcome.
Yep.
Nuclear simply doesn't emit much.
Right.
I got to tell you, there's a group in Canada that really kind of gets my goat, and that's the Ontario Clean Energy Alliance, led by Mr. Jack Gibbons. And
David Suzuki doesn't make the top of that list?
Well, David Suzuki seems to be anti-energy, or, you know, wants conservation as the source, and I understand that, but the Ontario Clean Energy Alliance seems to have no real issue with natural gas as a power source, and would much prefer natural gas over nuclear power, even though nuclear power is far lower in emissions.
So what kinds of trickery do they use in their literature to make natural gas sound better, or do they not even resort to numerical arguments?
They don't really use trickery. They just simply say that natural gas is much cleaner than coal, and when you ask them, well, how are you going to pay for this additional natural gas, because the price of natural gas is going up and up, and right now the generation cost for natural gas is about three times what it is for coal or nuclear, and that's with, you know, today's gas prices as opposed to the gas prices that were in effect last summer. He doesn't really have much of an answer. He says, well, there's new supplies coming online. And the fact is, there's going to be new supplies and there's new discoveries, but the overall production is remaining pretty constant in North America because there is also a depletion of all of the existing supplies every day.
Yep.
So you got to have new supplies, new announcements, new discoveries being announced, but what they don't tell you is that each day, each well that's producing is probably producing just a little bit less than it was the day before.
Yep.
For most part.
So. Speaking of natural gas and cost of fuel, here's another Canadian technology I thought I'd mention tonight that I honestly hope will get a chance to shine one day. It's the slowpoke technology. The slowpoke technology started off as a research reactor, and there was actually a design developed as a level 3 design, or a slowpoke 3 design, that was designed as a standalone residential heating system, where you could have a single 10 or 15 megawatt thermal, basically hot water heater, at the bottom of a well under 30 or 40 feet of water, and it would heat the water coming into this very deep cylinder by convection, and then the water that comes through the top would heat a loop in an apartment building, for instance. And considering that it gets fairly cold in Canada in the wintertime, having grown up close to Canada, I can attest to this. It probably gets even colder there. The slow poke technology was neat. Plus, you know, to my knowledge, it's one of the only technology, the research reactor was the only technology that was licensable to be operated unattended overnight.
Well, it is a neat technology, and for places where there are existing district heating systems, it's a great technology because you just hook it up to the hot water pipes and you're good to go.
And away you go. Plus the, as I recall, the fuel that would be used in Slowpoke 3 was basically the same enrichment and the same composition as pressurized water reactor fuel, 3 to 4 to 5% enrichment.
Do you have any idea what kind of refueling time that they would have?
I believe it was 20 years.
Wow, that's pretty nice.
It was a very slow reactor. It was very slow, very efficient, and used beryllium reflectors. The research arose out of how do we make a controllable, inherently safe reactor as small as possible.
Interesting.
The actual length of time that this Slowpoke 3 could go between refuelings, I think it was on the order of a decade.
Okay,
it might have been 20 years, but I'd have to look it up, and that'd take some time.
I assume it is a light water moderator.
Yes, it's a light water moderator. The what moderator it uses, it's light water moderated, but the bulk of how it operates is due to the fact that it has a fairly thick beryllium reflector around the core.
Okay. Now, we've focused mostly on what Ontario is doing, but there are, of course, other provinces in Canada, and one of the provinces that has expressed, or at least in editorials, have expressed a desire to investigate nuclear energy is kind of surprising on one level, and that's the province of Alberta, where there are vast quantities of heavy oil available in the oil sands regions of Alberta.
Yep, and there is a great paper that the Canadian Nuclear Society has up on their site. You can Google for AECL, CANDU, tar, CNs, hydrogen, any combination of the terms will get you there. It's a paper by John Donnelly and Dwayne Pendergast of Marengo Energy Research Limited and AECL, respectively. And they gave this paper and presentation in 1999, 7 years ago, and now it's starting to bear fruit, where the cost of using the natural gas to bring the oil out of the tar sands by an in-situ process, which is pretty neat, is starting to be looked at in comparison with using nuclear heated steam to drive the oil out of the formations. And the current technology for bringing the oil sands out, it's not much better than mining coal. I mean, they go in there with mining equipment and literally open pit mine the stuff out of the soil. And that tears up the earth and makes lots of unpleasant looking holes and does all kinds of environmental damage. The technology that they're looking at is an in-situ process where they drill some wells down and then bring the wells across under the deposit and then basically inject water and steam under high pressure with some hydrogen, and it causes the oil to separate from the sand and then come back out through the well. And basically you can take the oil out of the sand without having to dig a giant hole.
But that's an energy-intensive process.
So that is an extremely energy-intensive process. It's one of the reasons why it's not caught on, is because it would require huge amounts of natural gas to heat the water and be thermochemically reformed into hydrogen to upgrade. Now, the alternative technology, which Drs. Donnelly and Pendergast talked about, is to use a CANDU reactor to provide both hot water and electrolyze some of that water to hydrogen. So you have a nuclear power plant or a nuclear steam plant on site providing that intensive energy to do the processing.
Of course, we can't really discuss Canada and nuclear power without talking about the fact that Canada is one of the world's has one of the world's richest resources with regard to uranium compared to any other country in the world.
Yep.
I think they're number two, right behind Australia in terms of reserves, and I believe that their production is number one in the world.
Right, and they have the number two size of deposits in the world, and curiously enough, the deposits are in the same province. Many of them are as the oil sands. The oil sands are in the southern part of Alberta, and then the big uranium deposits like MacArthur River are in the northern end of the province. And there's some other deposits to either side in Saskatchewan and the other provinces and going up into Northwest Territories. As a matter of fact, there's a lake, I believe it's in Northwest Territories, called Lake... There's a bunch of geographic formations and lakes and stuff. They're named after the deposits. I think there's a Lake Radium, or there's for certain a Yellowknife, which is a town in, I believe it's either in the Nunavut Territories or in the Northwest Territories. It escapes right now. But the uranium mining industry up there has a long history, and it actually goes back before the nuclear power industry started in Canada, because the uranium deposits up there were so rich that it was a economically mineable source of radium in the late 1900s or the late 1800s, early 1900s, before we had the ability to make more useful isotopes of nuclear technology.
And one of the things about Canada's uranium mines, that there are some mines in Canada where the uranium concentration in the ore is in excess of 20%,
yep,
which is highly unusual. It makes it really easy to make a profit from mining an ore that is that rich.
It's basically slightly dirty yellow cake sitting in drifts in the ground. And I believe some of the mines, since those percentages are so high, they actually use remote mining techniques where they don't actually have the miners up in the ore. They have remote guided machines and some robots that actually go and drill out vertical tubes into the ore body and let the material fall down the tubes into cars at the bottom of the tube and drifts on rail tracks, and they basically mine away at the ore body remotely.
Wow. One of the other things that's kind of neat about Canada's uranium mining industry is that one of their largest companies involved in that industry is Cameco. And Cameco's web page now introduces itself as Cameco Corporation Uranium, Gold, Fuel, Electricity, Mining, Milling, and Refining. They're a highly integrated company that has recognized that it might be good for companies that make a good living from mining and selling uranium to invest in some power plants that use uranium. I have always wished that the Uranium Enrichment Corporation in the United States would recognize that it might be good to invest in nuclear power plants that would use their product, and, oh, by the way, supply cheaper electricity to their very energy-intensive process.
One-stop shopping.
Well, there is such a thing
to as... To put a very, very simple way of putting it.
Well, one-stop shopping, but also if part of the reason that you're not growing as a business is that people are not buying enough of your product, it always makes sense to have somebody who is kind of locked into buying your product.
Right. Oh, by the way, I found the name of that town in Canada I was trying to remember. It's called Port Radium.
Ah, Port Radium, yes. Yep. So I think that we've kind of done a quick summary. I'm sure there's lots and lots more to talk about,
right,
and I hope that people who are involved in the Canadian nuclear industry will step on board and either chime in and congratulate us on a job well done, or say, wow, we really got it wrong. But the bottom line
I'll
is...
I'll take the credit for that.
What, getting it right? Yeah,
getting it wrong.
Right. You'll be the get-it-right guy, and I'll just be the guy who... Anyway, so Canada's has got as long a history in nuclear energy as anybody. Many Canadians were involved in the American Manhattan Project and immediately went back to Canada and continued on, and I believe that the first CANDUs were coming online about the same time as the first PWRs. So it's an industry that they know well. It's an industry where they have some of the world's smartest people working at it, and I wish them the best of luck because, quite honestly, the electricity market in the United States is pretty well tied into the electricity market in Canada, and I hope that we can buy some of their supplies in some places.
Growing up, all the power that we got in our household all came from Canada, and we had utility lines, what they call hydro lines in Canada, coming from Ontario and Quebec practically through our backyard on their way south to New York City. So I got a chance to see Canadian electricity exporting up close and personal for a good part of my life.
That's good. Well, Shane, it's been wonderful. It's been fun. I think it's about time to call it a night,
right,
or a day, or whatever time people are listening to this show. Come visit us on the blog associated with the podcast at atomic.thepodcastnetwork.com. Check out some of the other great shows on the podcast network, and we'll see you next time.
Until later, everybody.
Excuse me, Scott. Do you know how I can get more out of my digital camera?
Sure I do, Michael. Listen to the Digital Photography Show on the Podcast Network. Every week they have terrific tips and tricks for improving your digital images, as well as the latest scoop on the newest cameras, software, and other accessories to make your digital images great. They even have interviews with famous photographers and writers and lots of fun contests. You should give it a try.
Sounds perfect. Where would I find the Digital Photography Show?
Just go to digifoto.thepodcastnetwork.com.
How did you find out about the Digital Photography Show?
Well, I'm the host, and Michael, you're the co-host.
Oh, that's right.
The Digital Photography Show. Listening's a snap.
You're listening to the Podcast Network. Listen, learn, evolve.